MacFound.org.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757. And if you're dialing locally, it's 297-5757. This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will visit with renowned Bible scholar and best-selling author James Tabor. He's known for his provocative work on the origins of Christianity and in a fascinating new book, Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. Dr. Tabor contends that Paul was the most influential defining figure in Christianity, even more so than Jesus himself. Also, Rebecca Costas, an American sociobiologist who offers a genetic explanation for current events, emerging trends, and individual behavior. She believes that everything from terrorism, debt, epidemic obesity, and upheaval in the Middle East have evolutionary imperatives. And we'll talk about Turkey Day, of course, as we celebrate Thanksgiving Eve. Glad you're with us on WRKF.
MacFound.org.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757. And if you're dialing locally, it's 297-5633. You may reach us always via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Kevin Gallagher is producing. We're glad you're with us on Thanksgiving Eve. Tomorrow we will be doing a live show on Thanksgiving Day, and our main guest will be Dr. Michael Kurtz of Southeastern Louisiana University, one of the foremost authorities on the Kennedy assassination, and tomorrow will mark 49 years since the death of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy in Dallas. But we start today with a fascinating gentleman, James Tabor, chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. He previously held positions at Notre Dame and William and Mary. He's often consulted by national media, appeared in Time, Newsweek, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, as well as ABC, CBS, Frontline from PBS, and A&E and the History Channel, among others. And he is here to talk about his latest work from Simon & Schuster, Paul and Jesus. In the book, Dr. Tabor opens up a message of the Apostle Paul in a vivid, engaging narrative, making clear what Christianity owes to Paul and the importance of our understanding of the apostle. Challenging, eye-opening, and certain to be controversial, the book is bound to compel any reader who wants to better understand the deepest roots of Western civilization and Christian culture. And good morning to you, Professor James Tabor.
Good morning, Jim. It's good to talk to you.
Well, why do you think that Paul may be the most influential person in human history?
It sounds extravagant, doesn't it?
It does.
Certainly, maybe we should say for the West, but because the West is so dominant, I'm willing to say human history. And we would usually think of Moses, Jesus, Socrates, Plato. Those would be kind of our first choices, I think. But I would start with Jesus. I think unquestionably Jesus is going to be number one in most people's minds. But the point about Paul is that Paul is really the lens through which we get Jesus primarily. In other words, without Paul going into the world, taking a message of Jesus, writing most of the New Testament, I'm thinking Jesus, I'm just speaking historically here, not theologically, just in terms of historical influence, Paul put Jesus on the road. As Jesus didn't write anything himself, he didn't travel outside of the ancient land of Israel. And so, and even the ideas, you know, when we talk about the more controversial ideas, what makes Christianity the religion that it is, it's coming more from Paul than Jesus. Jesus really fits pretty well into Judaism. And I ask my classes often, you know, kind of jokingly as I start a course on Jesus, wait a minute now, was he a Jew or a Christian? And they kind of laugh because they, you know, most of them recognize he was. If you go to synagogue and you keep Passover and Yom Kippur and where it's, you know, tzitzit and so forth, it's pretty identifiable as Jewish. Now, Paul was Jewish too, but the religion that he began to shape went beyond Judaism. And so that would be my argument.
Well, after the death and resurrection of Jesus, as Christians believe, what did Paul do after that that made him so significant in world history?
Well, in the book I talk about Christianity before Paul and then the Christianity of Paul. See, Paul comes along. The first letter we get from Paul, we date to about 50 A.D., and Jesus died in 30. So we've got a kind of a 20-year period there. And Paul comes along, and he doesn't really encounter the apostles. Jesus' brother James is in charge of the movement, and the well-known Peter and John, the Apostle John, the 12 apostles, for about 20 years later, as he says in the letter of Galatians. And so Paul is, he represents a version of the faith that's later. And so in the book, I try to talk about his version as well as the version from that 20-year period before he came along, because he's so influential. But the main thing, I think, to emphasize is Paul never met Jesus. And Paul says emphatically, I did not get my message from the apostles. So I think a lot of people have in their heads, you know, Jesus chose the apostles, and then he kind of chose Paul a little later, because Paul had the vision on the road to Damascus, and then they all worked together. And what my book argues is that that's a nice Sunday school version, but historically it isn't the case.
You say, for example, Dr. Tabor, that there is evidence that the two great apostles, Peter and Paul, were bitter rivals.
There is that evidence. I know it sounds shocking to people, and even some of the tension, though, is in his own letters. If you read the book of Acts, which is the early history of the movement, and very pro-Paul, the author Luke, you could almost call it the Acts of Paul rather than the Acts of the Apostles, after chapter 7, it's all Paul. So Paul's the hero of that book, and some of the tensions are there, but Luke's writing later when things have settled down, and you know, you can't blame him for wanting to give a kind of rosy picture, but Paul's letters, especially the letter of Galatians, he speaks pretty sarcastically. Like he says, I went up to Jerusalem after 17 years after his conversion, and he said, I saw the so-called pillars of the church. He uses the term so-called, you know. And he says, what they are means nothing to me because I speak directly to Jesus Christ. So you get this tension set up. And then in the next chapter, too, he said there was a fight at Antioch, which is north of Jerusalem, up where Syria is today. And he said, I withstood Peter to the face and denounced him in front of everybody. So I think people haven't dwelt on that much, but I try to get at what was that controversy. I even call it the Battle of the Apostles.
Yeah.
And it isn't just Peter, Jim. It's also James. Both of us have that namesake, but, you know, James, the brother of Jesus, is probably the most unacknowledged person in the New Testament. But if you read it carefully, he's the one that is really in charge of the movement. In other words, he kind of takes the place of Jesus, and then the 12 apostles look to him as the leader, and Paul and James just really spark one another.
All right, well, you say James, the brother of Jesus, as you know, certainly many Christians, particularly Catholics, don't believe that Jesus had biological brothers, but you say James was definitely his biological brother. How do you know that, Dr. Tate?
Well, you know, the common use, first of all, when Mary is named in the Gospels, it says, isn't she his mother, and aren't his brothers all with us? And it just names the brothers and mentions the sisters, just like your name in a family. And even the Catholic Church, the Roman Church, has said they're cousins. Now, the Greek Church they're divided. They say that they're children of Joseph by a different marriage. So they would be like, what, stepbrothers, not related biologically. Both of them would say that because Mary remains a perpetual virgin. But the perpetual virginity of Mary is a later teaching. It's more of a theology. And historians don't go by that, really. If you look in the Gospels after Jesus' birth, it plainly says that Joseph did not have relations with Mary until Jesus was born. But it uses the word until, implying, and then the brothers are named. So the normal reading would be brothers. But, you know, even if he wasn't a biological brother, which I think he was, but he's still the leader, and that would be the point.
Okay. Now, Peter and Paul, they were killed at about the same time, weren't they?
Yeah, we don't know exactly. We have traditions, and it would be in the reign of Nero, I'm going to say maybe 64 A.D., and we do know there was a huge persecution of Christians that year. Remember the fire in Rome where half of Rome burns down, kind of like the Chicago fire in our history? And Nero blames the Christians, and it looks like Peter and Paul might have got caught up in that persecution. Peter is crucified upside down, is the tradition, and Paul is beheaded. And yet we just don't have details. You know, we have legends, nothing from the time.
Beheading, that's not a pleasant way to depart the world.
Yeah, Paul, believe it or not, the crucifixion, though, is worse, and it's only for non-Roman citizens. And so since Paul's a Roman citizen, they saw the beheading as the honorable death, you know, quick and dignified, and the crucifixion as the torture death. So Peter, as a peasant, you know, from Galilee, is allowed to be crucified, but Paul is beheaded, according to that, mm-hmm. the story.
Now, you reflect in the book Paul and Jesus from Simon and Schuster that Paul's transformation of the Jewish concept of resurrection and the afterlife, which would have been held by Jesus and his earliest followers, was something very different than we have been informed. Why?
Yeah, that's a very important part of the book. It's the whole chapter. Paul is really our earliest witness to the resurrection. You know, when you open your New Testament, you read it in order and you start with the Gospels. But the Gospels are later than Paul, quite a bit later, you know, 20, 30 years later than Paul. So if you go by Paul, he's the earliest witness to resurrection. And he talks about the old body being shuffled off like clothing, and then the new body being kind of like a spiritual body, almost like a butterfly coming out of a cocoon. So the cocoon gets left behind. So in Paul, the bones or the physical body would not disprove the resurrection, which for many people today, they would say, well, you know, if somebody leaves their bones behind, then they're not raised from the dead. So Paul develops this idea of a spiritual body, and the reason, I think, is because that's what he sees in his vision. He doesn't see a flesh and blood human being up in heaven. He sees this glorified, he describes it as a blinding light and a glorified being. So that Paul's teaching and everything he bases himself on are these visionary. You know, today we would probably call it clairvoyant, but if we want to be less, because clairvoyant maybe has a bit of a pejorative feeling to it, his visionary experiences. But he says, kind of proudly, we no longer know Jesus after the flesh, he says. Meaning, you know, we don't know the human Jesus, we know the divine Jesus.
Well, the book is Paul and Jesus from Dr. James Tabor, who's been writing about religion and Christ for some time. He is the author previously of the Jesus Dynasty, and we'll spend a bit more time as we come back after the break with Dr. Tabor. He says that Paul transformed Jesus himself into the founder of a new religion that promised otherworldly salvation in a heavenly realm. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. Later in the hour, Dr. Rebecca Costa. Her book is The Watchman's Rattle, A Radical New Theory of Collapse. Back with James Tabor after this one-minute pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. James D. Tabor, chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, is with us for a few minutes longer. 297-5633 is the number if you'd like to join the conversation. You may reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. His book is Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. James Tabor has noted that Paul never knew Jesus, but he is the one who spread the message. Without Paul, what kind of Christianity would we have if we did not have the words of Paul to provide a roadmap?
I think the best look at that would be the letter of James. In the back of the New Testament, unfortunately, it's kind of ignored. This is James, the brother of Jesus. There is a five-chapter letter. It's not a lot, but it would be the Christianity we'd have without Paul. It really is closer to Judaism. It actually counters some of Paul's views, and I suggest in the book that readers just be aware that we really have a Christianity before Paul and then a Christianity forged by Paul. And some theologians can harmonize that, and others can't. And I really, it's not, as you know, Jim, it's not a Paul bashing book. I really, you could probably figure out if you read it carefully, you know, my personal preferences. But I try to be as fair as I can with saying, this is Paul, and this is James, and, you know, these are the historical facts. Without at the end saying, and you should think this, you know, you should vote. So I try to, you could almost call it Paul in his own words, because I concentrate in the book. And I think it's very readable. I should point that out to people. Sometimes if you hear about a book on Paul, you think, oh, well, that's going to be really a challenge. But I wrote it as for the non-specialist.
Mike in Pride. Mike, you're on with Dr. Tabor. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Hello, Dr. Tabor. How you doing?
Dr. Tabor's doing fine. What's your question?
My question is that I know that Dr. Tabor is an expert on cults, as he was an expert witness in the Waco trials, and I would just like for him to talk a bit about how the Christianity of Paul escalated to the magnitude of the Christian church today.
Okay. I'm okay,
yes,
Jim?
Yes, go ahead.
It's a good question because, you know, the Romans would have certainly considered Paul's movement. You know, you got to picture little house churches meeting here and there dotting the Roman Empire, and they were very suspicious of this movement. Once it broke from Judaism, during Paul's time and after Paul's time, they would call it a cult. So the way our culture would look at Waco or some of the Jonestown or some of these kind of groups, and even the same kind of charges, like they're sexually immoral, they're suicidal, they despise death. We actually have sources where the Romans are charging the Christians with these kind of, you know, crimes. So it's a long story. It takes about 200 or 300 years for the church to emerge out of that ghetto, really, that kind of cultic ghetto, and become a bona fide religion during the time of Constantine. But I do think it was the letters of Paul that helped that, because they have an intellectual side to them that ended up engaging even the minds of somebody as brilliant as Augustine. You know.
All right, 297-5633 in our remaining time with Dr. James Tabor, the author of Paul and Jesus. Dan downtown. Hello, Dan. You're on the air.
Yes, Dr. Taper. I came across something recently that said that atheists and agnostics are more informed about the Bible than self-described Christians. Do you believe that to be so, and if so, why?
You know, it would be hard to generalize, I think, because obviously some Christians are well-informed and others aren't, and some atheists are. But the Bible is a public book. In our culture, it's even in every hotel room. So I suppose many who give up their religion and become atheists probably struggle. You know, they read a lot and maybe were even raised in the Bible. So it could be that often that would be the case, but it would be hard to generalize.
297-5633 is your number. Kevin, let's take a few more calls for Dr. James Taber, the author of Paul and Jesus. And Dr. Taber is one who's not shy from controversial subjects. Deborah in Glen Oaks. Good morning, Deborah.
Yes.
You're on with Dr. Taber.
With the advent of this information coming out, things like Mary not being a virgin and Jesus having a brother, do you think that the church is going to have to rethink its opinion on these subjects and perhaps even the doctrine?
Good question. You know, the church, the conservative wings of the church, both Catholic and Protestant, probably are going to stay with the traditional teachings no matter what. That's now, maybe 500 years from now, it could be different, but certainly in our lifetime. And I think part of it is these things are seen as threatening. But the people, I'm telling you, as you probably know, the people read widely, they think. And many of the pastors and priests and leaders in seminary are studying the very things I write about, but they often feel, well, you know, we shouldn't really share this with the flock because it might be upsetting. But you might know of some churches where the pastors and really see themselves more as enlightening the people, and so they don't simply repeat the dogmas of tradition. And it really depends where you are and you know, what church you attend or what you listen to.
Tom on Bluebonnet. Tom, good morning. You're on the air with Dr. James Taber.
Good morning, Doctor. I was wondering if you were familiar with, and would you comment on, if you are, the depiction of Paul in The Last Temptation of Christ, and also if you had some comments about the near-total absence of Jesus' teachings in Paul's letters. Thank you.
Yeah, the fact, you know, I can't remember in the film that maybe Paul appears at the end or something, but so I can't really comment on that. But your second point I write about quite a bit. Since Paul never met Jesus, anything he would know of Jesus would have to come from, you know, the tradition and the apostles. Nothing is written that early that we know of. But what's amazing is Paul really doesn't, as you indicate, he doesn't really quote Jesus very much. He knows a little bit. He's really more interested in the theology of Jesus, that he died for your sins, that he was raised from the dead. And so you remember the Apostles' Creed? It jumps from the birth, born of a virgin, to crucified, died, and buried in one sentence, meaning his life is just skipped. And that becomes the Pauline Creed. He's crucified, he's born, and he's crucified. Whereas James and the other followers would want to say, wait a minute, you know, there's the teaching of Jesus, how to live, and that's much more of a Jewish approach. Not so much what do you believe, but how do you treat your neighbor? What is justice? What is righteousness?
How old was Paul when Jesus was crucified?
You know, I, in my book, suggest that they were born exactly the same year, and so he would be 31, 2, or 3 years old. They're identical age, I think, which is very interesting to think about.
It is. And Where was he when this happened?
Well, we think he was in Jerusalem, and yet he never mentions, you know, he never says, I saw Jesus crucified or anything like that. So we maybe, and it was Passover, and so we have to assume he was there. But did he actually witness the crucifixion and not mention it? He certainly became aware of the movement. I wish we knew. It's something to think about. You would think that the whole city would have known that these people were being crucified on the day before Passover.
And Peter was a few years older?
Now, Peter's age we don't know. Unfortunately, we don't know the age of anybody except Jesus, because, and that is kind of a guess, you know, from when he was born, and then you begin to figure it out. We just don't know anything about the age of the others. It's never recorded.
Well, one of the ingredients in the book that I'm sure will stir the passions of many biblical scholars is the friction that was apparent between Paul and Peter. Now, Catholics trace the origin of the Roman Church to Peter, who is acknowledged as the first pope. Is that something you can live with as a historical context?
No, not really. I think the first, if pope means the universal leader of the church, not just the Bishop of Rome, then the first pope would be James, meaning, but pope is probably not appropriate term since this is a Jewish movement, but the leader, you know, the one who's in charge is James, and then Peter and John are his two attendants, you might say. But whether Peter, I mean, he makes it to Rome and dies in Rome, but I think the idea that he's the Bishop of Rome and he's the first pope is more of a Catholic tradition. And, of course, Protestants don't accept that either. So.
Well, the book is Paul and Jesus, and it is a controversial work from Dr. James Tabor, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity, and you have devoted your life to this subject. How many years have you been involved in biblical research and the origins
of
Christianity?
Well, I'm going to have to reveal my old age here. See, about 40 years. I wrote my dissertation at the University of Chicago on this, and so about 40, and I've been studying Paul for 40 years. I wanted to mention my blog, jamestabor.com, very easy to remember, because I will be a lot on the book and about Paul, and people can go there and read a lot of in-depth analysis that I post all the time there.
That's so. James Tabor, TABOR.com. Thank you,
That's
Dr.
Right.
Tabor, and hope you have a great Thanksgiving.
Okay, Jim, you too, and all of your listeners, thank you very much. I know a lot of people in the Baton Rouge area, so thank you.
Take care, my friend.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And now on Thanksgiving Eve, we are with a few people who have an interesting message regarding Turkey Day, with Louisiana leading the nation in obesity. We have a husband and a wife committed to fighting obesity. They are Patty Christopher and Gino Gambino, and they've lost nearly 300 pounds between the two of them after a relative died trying surgery that would address this. And good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
All right, so tomorrow, what kind of Turkey Day samplings will you have at the Gambino Christopher table with this weight loss mission that you're on?
Well, our weight loss program is no carbs and no fats, so there won't be any dressing, mashed potatoes. We do lots of fresh vegetables, lots of green beans.
Chicken or fish.
Chicken.
Maybe a hamburger, something like that we'll make.
What about sugar?
No sugar.
No sugar.
No. So.
No pies.
No pies. So what are you going to have?
Well, we do a really good apple, like cooked apples that's really good with cinnamon and stevia on it.
Yeah.
So just take a little saute pan and slice an apple in there and a little water and cinnamon and cook it down. It tastes like apple pie without the crust.
All right. So collectively, you two have lost 300 pounds.
No, about 200, almost 200 pounds. Yes.
Okay. So that's still a lot of weight.
Right.
That's last time I checked. If we average it out, about 100 pounds each. How did you do it, and how long did it take?
We lost the weight almost 4 years ago, about 3.5 years ago, using the HCG diet. At the time, we lived in Las Vegas, and we started our first round there. And it's a 40-day session, and in 40 days we lost about 35 pounds apiece, and knew that we had found the answer to helping people lose weight and the answer to obesity.
Well, and you've written a book about it.
We have.
The Real People's Guide to the HCG Diet.
Right.
Now, is that Christopher and Gambino? Is that the,
yes.
So what is the H?
What's that?
Oh, what is the H? HCG is actually a natural hormone that's in everyone's bodies. We didn't invent this. It's been around for about 80 years as a weight loss program.
Where?
Yeah.
But you've tried other diets?
Oh, everything.
I had my stomach stapled back in the 80s.
Yeah?
I was 315 pounds at the time, and I had it stapled. I was in CCU for 2 days. I lost 60, 70 pounds. I put it all back on. Because I bust the staples out.
Oh, my. So you fought this battle, as many do.
Yeah.
Exercise is certainly a good component. Do you do much of that?
I've paid for a lot of gyms over the years.
You know, it's interesting. People quite often join gyms, and they'll park their cars as close to the door as they can.
Right.
To go to the gym.
Right.
But exercise, diet, moderation, some folks are saying you might be taking this a bit too far to just completely eliminate so many things from your diet. How do you enjoy life?
Well, it's only a short program that you do. The longest you can do this program is 50 days at a time. Then we go into 3-week maintenance on that. With that, you're changing your eating habits and you're resetting your metabolism. So we don't live on this all the time. We still enjoy life.
All right. 297-5633 HB in Denham Springs. You're on with Gino Gambino and Patty Christopher. Hi, HB.
Good morning and happy Thanksgiving to everybody with all the health and happiness. Question is this. Many health experts have said here recently in the last year or 2 years, whatever, that obesity has now surpassed smoking as the number one health hazard in our country. And I think General Honoré said that really it is a threat to our national security. Your opinion, please.
Oh, I totally agree. We totally agree. The obesity rate in America, and especially in the South here in Louisiana, Mississippi, is totally out of control. And there are so many things that affect what we eat affects how you your brain and how you function and your mobility. And there's just obesity is just really, really taking the quality of life down for Americans. And
I was talking to a chef one day at the farmer's market, and she says, what do we need to do for our kids in obesity? Well, I said, you need to start with the parents, because it's much easier for somebody to run through a drive-through and pick up a cheap meal and feed their kids than actually go do the shopping and the cooking. So that causes with this, and with it is getting to be a very serious problem. Because of when I was a size 52 pair of pants, I couldn't find none. Now they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm. That's 52 waist?
Yes.
Yeah. What are you now?
I'm right at between a 40 and 42.
Now that's still probably a little above where it should be.
Yes, it is.
So right. What are you going to do?
The HCG diet.
we have after the holidays, we're going to do another session.
All right, 297-5633, Susan on Perkins. Hi, Susan. You're on with Gino Gambino and Patty Christopher. Hi, Susan.
Hi, and hi, Patty, and hi, Gino. This is Susan Crowther.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, just want to attest. In fact, I just went by your office. It was closed.
All right, what's your question, Susan?
I was just going to say that I've been on the diet, and it works wonderfully, and the theories and the research behind it make perfect sense, so I'd recommend it to anyone.
All right. Another question. A listener wants to know, what about alcohol? Can you drink?
Not during the HCG. So the key to it all is that the HCG is a natural hormone. It's human chlorine gonadotropin is what it's called, and it actually burns fat off of your body. So while you're doing that, you're losing about a pound a day, but you're not eating any carbs or sugar or oils, fats.
Okay. Hold that thought. We'll be back, spend a few more minutes with Patty Christopher and Gino Gambino, and also hear from Dr. Rebecca Costa. Her book is The Watchman's Rattle. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Happy Thanksgiving Eve to you. And coming in a few moments, we'll hear from Rebecca Costa, a provocative book, The Watchman's Rattle, is her work. And we wrap it up with Gino Gambino and Patty Christopher, two nice folks from our community who have lost 200 pounds on something called the HCG diet. And as we approach Thanksgiving, some folks say you can eat pretty much what you want, just don't eat a whole lot of it. Portion control. What do you say to those people?
I agree with that. I agree with that. The problem becomes when you're eating all the synthetic high fructose corn syrups and imitation synthetic sugars and stuff like that. But yes, if you're eating real pie with real sugar and real butter, go, yep,
and
in moderation.
We're not a moderate city, state, culture. We enjoy food in this area, and we have the people to show for it. A lot of big people out there.
Right.
So some would say this is a downer on Thanksgiving Eve, Gino. What do you tell people as far as how they should approach a day when many people gorge?
Thanksgiving is just one day. It's just one meal. Just, you know, take it a little simpler. Put more fruits and vegetables on your plate, a little bit less dressing, a little turkey, something that's going to make you feel a little bit better. Because most people, what they do is they eat until they just have to undo their pants. And after the first three bites of a food, you don't taste it anymore. So they're eating just to be greedy, and they're just eating to do something. So if you make a little smaller plate and put some fruit on there, some vegetables on there, and I'm not talking about the broccoli with all the cheese and the cauliflower with all the cheese and the string beans. More of a healthier meal. And just make it through the day. It's just one day.
All right. The book is The Real People's Guide to the HCG Diet. It's available in bookstores in the area from Patty Christopher and Gino Gambino. Happy Thanksgiving to both of you, and
thank you.
Good luck.
It's available
keep,
on
keep
our
keep
website
that,
also.
And do you want to give the...
The website, you can go to Real People's Guide to the HCGDiet.com. Or also available at WasteAway, WASTAWAYLLC.com.
Thank you very much.
Website.
Good
Thank
to
you.
See both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And
Thank
a lot
you.
Less of you. Now we're joined by Rebecca Costa. She's an American sociobiologist and offers a genetic explanation for current events, emerging trends, individual behavior. And she believes and traces everything in her book, The Watchman's Rattle, from terrorism, debt, obesity, and upheaval in the Middle East, to evolutionary imperatives. Good morning to you, Rebecca.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Nice to talk with you. Now, we've been talking about obesity here. Now, how is that an evolutionary issue?
Well, in earlier times, our prehistoric relatives had trouble finding calories. And so buried deep in our DNA is a desire to find calories. So it's not the evolutionary imperative that's changed, is the environment. Now I can find, I can find a donut on every corner, right? But in earlier times, when there were food scarcity, those organisms that were experts at identifying high-calorie foods, they survived. And their predecessors didn't make it if they were, you know, the kind that looked for celery and carrots, right?
Right.
I mean, their DNA isn't walking around the earth. So in times of food shortages and water shortages, it's those organisms that were able to identify high-calorie foods that whose genetic material survived on the earth in modern times if they were in areas where there were food shortages. So I can say for myself and probably Oprah Winfrey and any number of people that if you got a table and you got some glazed donuts on it or some carrot sticks, my hand wants to go for the glazed donuts, even though I know in my brain I'm a rational human being, I should never eat a donut again for the rest of my life. So why can't I overcome that? And the simple explanation is we like to think that, you know, because we wear clothes and have smartphones and drive cars and fly in airplanes that we've cleansed our DNA of everything irrational, but no, the fact that we're still territorial. You know, I had somebody ask me the other day, hey, you know, I don't believe that I have any genetic imperatives that are getting in my way in modern times. And I said, well, let's just conduct a little experiment. The next time you go to the grocery store, don't waste all your time going up and down the aisles. I said, just go straight to the checkout stand, start shopping out of other people's carts. They haven't paid for that stuff. It doesn't belong to them. I said, you'll be in fisticuffs in less than 4 minutes. So, you know, my book is mainly about looking at the fact that every country in the world has the same list of dangerous problems. They're trying to create jobs. They're worried about energy. They're worried about illegal immigration. You know, their economies are in a dangerous situation. And, you know, at some point, if you look at every country and every type of political system and every type of economic system, and they all got the same problems, at some point a light bulb ought to go off, and we ought to be able to say, hey, you know what? We seem to be going through something that's species-wide. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, the watchman's rattle tries to connect the dots between not only obesity but crime, oil prices, global warming, nuclear waste, childhood violence. All of this is related to the subject that we're talking about. Do you think there's a connection that is similar to each one of these issues?
Absolutely, because we can go back into earlier times, the Roman civilization, Khmer, the great Egyptian Empire, the Ming Empire, and we can see that at a certain point they become gridlocked, and then the second symptom prior to collapse appears, which they become confused about what are the facts and what are opinions and just an unproven belief. And then finally the third symptom is public policy becomes irrational. Now those symptoms appear way before they're headed off the cliff. Right, I'm not really interested in the cataclysmic event that throws a society off the cliff. It's too late then, right? But I'm interested in that long, slow drive toward the cliff and what happens in evolution to cause that. And the fact is that we made a major discovery. We've discovered, it's going to sound obvious when I say it, but there are two clocks. One clock, every time the hand moves, it's millions of years, and the human body has developed some new cognitive feature like the frontal cortex, or we stood upright or developed opposable thumbs. And the other clock, every time a hand moves, it's human progress. We now have smartphones that will carry 200,000 apps on them. You know, according to Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, we're developing as much information in 2 days, in 48 hours, as we developed from the dawn of mankind to year 2003. So obviously we're facing degrees of complexity that we're just simply not designed to manage. We haven't evolved the capabilities to manage this. So this is why when we hear things like a communication didn't get to the State Department from Benghazi, do we have any idea the millions of communications that come in from embassies all around the world? This isn't any administration's fault. It's not any individual's fault. We're all collapsing under complexity.
The book is The Watchman's Rattle, A Radical New Theory of Collapse, from Rebecca Costa. And Rebecca writes that perhaps nowhere is the conflict between economics and human progress more polarized than in the ongoing debate over health care. When it comes to the trade-off between human life and profits, we are a society that clearly has two frames of mind. Could you expand?
Yeah. Since the beginning of time, we've basically been in an argument in our bodies. We know that when we collaborate, we've been able to fight off enemies that were larger than ourselves, capture prey that was bigger, and allow the troop to prosper. So we know collaboration is a very important tool, and we're natural-born collaborators. But we also are schizophrenic about that. We also have a competitive side. We're greedy. We want stuff for ourselves. And we go back and forth. Religion is all about that discussion. In my view, religion and evolution are completely compatible. In evolution, we say that the higher instruments of our genetic inheritance are arguing with our lizard brain. But in religion, it's the things that you know are morally correct versus the things that your body tells you you want to do, like eat a donut.
Well, you bring out some of the economic issues regarding the healthcare industry, noting that in 2007, the top 20 big pharma companies had a combined net income of approximately $110 billion, more than half of the government's loan to AIG. Now, this is big business, isn't it?
If they'd all just throw in a few percentage points of their profit this year, we could take care of a large percentage of the debt. And yet what we have to understand is in a complex society, you know, let's back up for a moment. There's nothing more complex than our tax code. And I know this because I used to work for General Electric Company. And let me tell you, GE has buildings and buildings and buildings of tax accountants who are legally finding ways that they don't have to pay any taxes whatsoever. Now, let's contrast that against you and me who goes to H&R Block and throws them a couple hundred bucks and says, see, can you shave anything off my taxes? You know, you're already beat before you get started. But this is the problem. When you have greater complexity than the human brain is really designed to manage, there's an unfair advantage to those who can go out and manipulate the system through computers, through technology, and through other devices that we've generated.
The Watchman's Rattle is from Rebecca Costa, who was raised in Tokyo. You've had an interesting voyage in your life, Rebecca.
I have. My father was working for the CIA. Of course, we didn't know that till we were in college. We thought he had a kind of a strange job with strange hours, but in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, you don't really know what your dad did. It's considerably different from families today. So I grew up in Japan, and from there I lived in Laos and Thailand and Cambodia, and then came here to the United States to attend college. And it really helped me because it allowed me to see that all human beings were effectively struggling with the same thing, which is the definition of complexity is that there are more wrong choices than right ones. And so over time, we're all trying to survive and navigate a high failure rate environment. Not just our government, but us individually. And I think if you talk to anybody who's even trying to retire these days, they're so confused their head wants to explode.
Hmm. You lived in Laos during the Vietnam era, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Many people, that story has not quite been written yet. Laos was a bit like Cambodia, only the United States had illegal operations in there. The CIA was running its own military force. And they had made a deal to transport drugs out of Laos and out of Cambodia, where heroin was being grown, in order to raise money to be able to purchase arms and bypass congressional approval. And so there were many thousands of Americans living in Laos and Cambodia at the time of the Vietnam War, and both of those countries had decided that they wanted to remain neutral, but they were far from.
Many startling observations are detailed in Rebecca's book, The Watchman's Rattle. You write, the pressure to act quickly has us comparing Wall Street to butter production in Bangladesh, limiting the number of toilets per house, blaming Saddam Hussein for 9/11. It leads to a society that rushes into war, rushes to write more new legislation, and rushes to fund the next big elixir everywhere. Rush, rush, rush.
Well, you know, we're evolved to deal with short-term danger. If I throw a snake down in front of someone, it just bypasses their brain and they jump away, right? You have fight and flight. Your body fills with chemicals. You sit down with a 20-year-old and you say, listen, there might not be any Social Security when you're my age. You can't get them to focus for 60 seconds. That's because the body itself is not designed to respond to long-term danger. That's why these people are so frustrated that are trying to talk about climate change or illegal immigration or the debt. The reason we didn't get on top of the debt and we're facing this financial cliff is because we don't have any mechanism physiologically to deal with long-term danger. It's not like that cliff just suddenly showed up. It takes a long time for a cliff to develop. And we know what the other cliffs are as well, by the way. And we're not doing anything about those. So we got to understand we have some biological obstacles here, just as all other nations, all other countries are fighting those biological obstacles. We've just evolved certain capabilities, and we're now up against those capabilities, and they don't favor the kinds of problems we have to deal with today.
Well, if we don't adjust our processes, where are we going as a people?
Well, the truth is I didn't want to write a negative book. I wanted to look and see if we had anything in modern times that would allow us to avoid collapse. And it turns out we do. Again, we're trying to, all of us, the person on the street and governments are trying to deal with a high failure rate environment. So if that's really the problem, then we need to look for models where you can succeed in spite of high rates of failure. And so the model that I use in the book is venture capital. Venture capitalists aren't really experts at success. They're experts at failure. For every 100 companies they invest in, they only expect maybe 10 or 15 to do well. But those successes will dwarf the losses that they have. And every venture capitalist I know is doing really well. So if you look in nature, you'll see that diversification is an antidote to high rates of failure. So when there's sudden changes in the environment, the fact that we have thousands of fish and thousands of birds, some will make it and some won't. And we've managed now to understand that on Wall Street. I don't think anybody's going to take their life savings and put it on one stock. We understand that when stocks go down, bonds go up or gold goes up. And so we understand that principle of diversification. But we don't seem to understand it when it comes to solving very dangerous problems like energy, like climate change, you know, like terrorism. We always seem to go for that one short-term elixir, and as we're so fond of saying, kick the can down the road. But now we're not kicking the can down the road. We're just kicking the can 2 inches from our foot.
Well, Bill Bradley, a great American, says understanding this book is a big step toward becoming the master of our own destiny. And Donald J. Trump says Rebecca Costa has written a riveting examination of our world's most dire and complex issues. You've got endorsements from other people as well, but certainly a contrast between Senator Bradley and Mr. Trump.
Yeah, and Richard Branson, Trudy Styler, you know, Bill Richardson. It's been a really humbling experience to have such a broad cross-section of people say that the book is easy to read, and it frames up our greatest threats in a very different way.
Well, the book is The Watchman's Rattle, A Radical New Theory of Collapse from Rebecca Costa. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you so much for having me.
And have a great Thanksgiving. And tomorrow on Thanksgiving Day, we will be live in studio and ready to talk with you. So we hope you'll join us tomorrow, as you do most days, we hope. And have a great day today. And keep listening to WRKF. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.